and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be with us tonight. Tonight we have with us Stephen Buhner, and we're going to talk about one of his many books called Healing Lines. Stephen's written many, many books on herbal medicine, and I think he's one of the best out there. So thank you so much, Stephen, for being with us. I know you have a really busy schedule, and I'm grateful to have you.
Hi, Eva. Thanks for having me on.
So before we get started, if you would take a minute to tell, I know you're not actively seeing clients, but you have someone that you work with, so if you could just tell people where to find your information and how to get in touch with the people that you work with in case they would like to get an appointment after the show sometime.
Well, my website is GaianStudies.org, G-A-I-A-N, studies.org. And, you know, my partner, Julie McIntyre, works with people. And, you know, I recommend another. She's in New Mexico, but she does work online. And I also recommend a number of other great practitioners around the country. Tommy Priester in Massachusetts is wonderful. Tim Scott in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Neil Nason, MD, in Northern California is also wonderful. So there's a number of great Lyme practitioners out there that work with a lot of different aspects of this group of diseases. And so things have really changed a lot in the past 10 years.
So where can people find this book? Can they get it on your site? Because a lot of people have this issue. Is it on Amazon, on this site? Where do they buy it?
Well, Amazon is an easy place to find all of that. And basically, 10 years ago, I wrote the first book in this series called Healing Lyme. And then as time went on and we learned a lot more and got more sophisticated in our work, I decided to begin to rewrite the book for a second edition. And I started on looking at the co-infections, because I have a number of the co-infections in that book that I talk about. And the co-infection books just got out of hand. So there was a book called Healing Lyme Disease Co-Infections that was released not that long ago that looks at treatment of Bartonella and Mycoplasma. And then there'll be one coming out next spring on Babesia, Ehrlichia, and Anaplasma. So, you know, this whole Lyme group of infections are very sophisticated, and they really needed a treatment. So this grouping of books, people can pretty much find them most easily on Amazon, really.
So just to give people the basics and not make this a really complicated thing since it's so much information, could you, and I don't want to make this really hard on you either because I know you've been busy lately, but could you tell us, you know, most people that are really, really tired, they don't know that they have something. Is it, how do they know if they have Lyme's, or how do they know if they have one of these co-infections? Are there specific symptoms?
Well, there are. And so just, you know, I think one of the best ways is to kind of get a little bit of a grounding in the dynamic. The grouping of Lyme disease co-infections, they're really known as stealth pathogens, and they're much different. Some people are calling them second-generation pathogens to sort of distinguish them from the kind of easier ones that antibiotics dealt with in the past, like staph infections or strep or things like that. And these particular infections, one of the things they have in common is when you get infected by them, you'll usually feel like you're having a case of the flu or something is quite often the first symptom. And really that flu feeling that we get when we're getting sick is the response of our immune system to the disease. It's certain kinds of interferons that the body produces that actually creates that feeling. And, of course, along with it is quite often an experience of really severe fatigue. And then it can go through massive range. They call these grouping of diseases the great imitators. sometimes because they can mimic nearly any other disease that people have. And that's one of the reasons why it's been so difficult to diagnose them. You know, most people don't understand that these diseases have only really sort of been known for about 20 years, and so the research has been extremely thin on them, and the doctors aren't really up to speed, and they don't really, there's not very many good tests for them, though they're getting better all the time. But in general, each one of the co-infections will have a slightly different symptom picture. Extreme fatigue is often one of them. Severe arthritis is extremely common in, like, mycoplasma, Bartonella, and Lyme all can cause really severe arthritic symptoms. Sometimes heart disease is involved, but generally the two most common presenting symptoms are really extreme fatigue and mental problems, because they can infect the central nervous system. So people will get forgetful. It can mimic multiple sclerosis sometimes, and so and that's part of the problem, is that when you just start feeling not right and your function is really going downhill and it's not getting better, then that's the time to start looking at whether you've picked up one of these kind of co-infections.
How do you, if you're trying to decide, I'm looking at your webpage now, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Under co-infections, you have 7 items listed. So how do you figure out which one or combination that you have? Are there any, like, key things that you would look for to help you distinguish?
Well, one of the things that we see, like, for instance, with Bartonella, bone pain, especially in the feet, is extremely common. And with Bartonella, extreme rage episodes that seem to come out of nowhere, and anemia, and fatigue. That's kind of the thing that goes with Bartonella. With mycoplasma, for instance, there would be a lot of people, because the mycoplasma bacteria, they scavenge all of their nutrients that they need from the body, so they can quite often cause a kind of wasting or nutrient deficiency dynamic that's extremely common, along with fatigue. And with Lyme disease, maybe 40% of the people, something like that, will get the bullseye rash that is talked about. But younger people will generally get really severe swelling in their knees, for instance. Bell's palsy can occur. But a lot of the time, it's just they start to have central nervous dysfunction. And really, in younger people that are having mental difficulties and a lot of fatigue, that's one of the main things that I think indicates that people should look at Lyme or one of the co-infections.
I'm writing, as you say. I just think this is so interesting. Okay, so once you want to just pick the headliner, and would Lyme be the headliner, or would one of these co-infections be the headliner?
Well, the interesting thing is Lyme disease is the thing. It was the one that was discovered first, because it was in Lyme, Connecticut, and they began calling it Lyme disease just simply because of the town there, and it was a researcher that discovered it, because there was sort of this complex of really strange disease symptoms that were happening amongst a lot of the people and the children in that town. And he found a previously undiscovered bacteria, spirochete, that was infecting them, and named it. So that's the one that kind of became the most famous. And most people really don't know about the other members of the group that go along with it, like Bartonella or mycoplasma, or, you know, even Rocky Mountain spotted fever, or Babesia or Ehrlichian anaplasma. Those are known, they're not quite as, you know, common in people's thought processes. But Bartonella, for instance, and mycoplasma are both extremely common in the United States population, you know, there's anywhere from 5 to 30 million people that are, you know, asymptomatically infected with both of those organisms. We can get them from our pets. Most dogs and cats are infected with them. And so there's fairly easy transmission. Like mycoplasma is transmitted by virtually every kind of biting insect that you can think of. Bartonella is much fewer. People tend to focus mostly on ticks because that's what they've heard about with Lyme disease, and they're very nervous about going into places where there's a lot of ticks. But even with Lyme disease, there's been instances of it being transmitted by biting flies and some other arthropods, so that, you know, they're still kind of figuring out how all of this works. In general, most people tend to focus on Lyme disease because it's the one they've heard of, and it's also kind of where most of the medical focus has been.
So if when I go back and look at my personal life, I know that I had a tick on me when I was a child. I can remember finding one time. But I also know that in my 20s, I worked in the operating room at UAB, and I got mycoplasmic pneumonia. I know that I've had strep throat in my life. I know that I have central nervous system issues. I feel them in my breastbone. I don't know if that makes any sense. So if people go back and look at their lives and see that they've had strep throat or pneumonia or maybe even little, I saw this man the other day, and he had these little white circles all over his skin, and he's a young guy, but I know that his father has terrible congestive heart failure and terrible inflammatory diseases. So if somebody knows that they've had all those things in their lives, is it a good possibility that they should look at these things?
Well, it's more, I think, the most important thing, we're kind of caught up, so let me just kind of try to shift the focus a little bit, because I think that's something that's really crucial with Lyme disease. We've all been raised with this whole idea of the bacterial theory of disease, okay? And that was kind of a new thing that Pasteur brought in, and it was hailed as this huge triumph. And so then with the discovery of antibiotics, and they become popular after World War II, beginning in about 1946, when people were given antibiotics for staph or strep infections or things like that, it was just miraculous how effective those things were. And we got into this way of thinking, you know, just from television ads and stuff we've read and all of the stuff that we hear, that, you know, when we get a disease, we'll get some sort of a pharmaceutical, an antibacterial of some sort, that will kill it and then we'll be fine again. Well, the problem was that's there's a certain area where that's accurate, but the great teaching of AIDS was that if your immune system isn't functioning, it doesn't matter how many pharmaceuticals you take, you're not going to be able to survive. And with these group of infections, the thing that's really crucial is, for instance, somebody could be asymptomatic for Bartonella for 20 or 30 years and be perfectly healthy and fine unless their immune function drops way down because of something that happens in their life, extended stress or whatever. And once that happens, then the Bartonella can bloom as an actual disease. So when you're working with this group of diseases, thinking you have to consider your vitality and immune health overall when you're looking at it to sort of help, because it doesn't really matter with these organisms, because quite often there's very few of them in the body, you know, compared to staph or strep or things like that. So if you build up your immune function and you sort of interfere with what they're doing in the body, then you get back to health, whether or not you've still got them there. So to respond more directly to your question, one of the things that people report when they just gradually get worse over a very long period of time until they don't have much functionality at all. And then they can remember back that they had these ticks that happened or these various things. Like for you, having mycoplasma pneumonia infection, how long ago did you say that was?
Probably 30 years.
Okay. one of the things about mycoplasma pneumonia is that they found is that people can be treated for that and it disappears out of the lung tissue. But then what happens is you can get this very mild systemic form of mycoplasma infection that very slowly begins to erode your function. And that if it gets established in the central nervous system, it can get established in virtually any part of the body. But if it gets established in the central nervous system, then you're going to start experiencing certain kinds of cognitive challenges and difficulties. And so that's one thing to look at if you've ever had that kind of infection. And then you compare the kind of the symptom picture that you're dealing with now to that, and you can get a sense of maybe, yeah, you've got this low-grade systemic mycoplasma infection that's been wearing down your health level for 30 years.
So what would someone's lab report, what would they look at if they go and get lab tests? Would they look at C-reactive protein or what do they look at? Because most doctors don't know, as you know.
No, they don't. And I mean, and that's the other
thing. Hey, let me cover us right here just for a minute. Sorry to interrupt you. We are not Stephen Buhner nor myself are attempting to treat or diagnose you. This entire show is for informational purposes only. I just want to make that clear because I don't want anybody getting in trouble for trying to treat or diagnose, and we're not trying to do that.
No,
sorry.
Well, like, for instance, with babesia, that's one of the very few that one of the primary signs is, you know, your liver values are going to be off, and that's quite common in that particular disease. With most of these others, you know, it's like people think, well, I can go and I'll get some tests and then they'll do this. But even if you get a blood test and they're looking for it, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of things that you could have going on with you. So the way we look at it mostly is we look at the symptom picture, and then we look at, you know, where you live. If you live in an area where there's a high chance that you could get one of these kinds of infections. And then if you go into the doctor for tests, the best thing to do, and they're getting much better at this now, not all of them by any means, maybe not even most of them, but you can get a test, a full panel test for Lyme and most of the co-infections. And that gives you a place to begin, and you can kind of cross-correlate that with some of the symptoms, like with Bartonella, one of the common symptoms that people will have is they could have really inflamed lymph nodes. And, I mean, they'll get up to the size of a golf ball or something quite large. And that's one of the real signs of that. And so that's sort of what you look for. It's not a very easy group of diseases to diagnose. And the best chance you have is if you suspect you have this, is like we often recommend Igenix lab for tests, but there's a number of labs that are showing up that can test for the full spectrum of the co-infectious group, and then, you know, that gives you a place to begin, really.
That's a wonderful thing. Who has a Lyme lab panel?
I think Igenix does. Igenix has that, and there's more people that are getting focused on that. And that's not usually where I spend a lot of my time because I don't, these books I was writing to like help people to understand the disease dynamics they were going through, and so also that physicians would be able to look at it and have a better understanding and be able to see how herbal medicines would play a big role in it, because they tend to be a lot more effective. For instance, only about 60% of the people that get antibiotics for these groups of diseases are helped by them. So for that other 40%, herbal medicines are really the primary thing that they can do to help turn it around. And I wanted to give people a really good idea of how this could work so that they could get the kind of support they needed, really.
You have a protocols on your website. By the way, you have really good protocols on your website for anybody that's
listening. You're talking, you must be talking about Buhner Healing Lyme. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm looking at, yes, Buhner Healing Lyme.
Okay, that's actually not my website. That's a woman named Julie Gensler, who suffered from Lyme disease and some of the co-infections, put that together so people would have an idea of my approach to Lyme disease. And she's been a bit more ill in the last year, so she hasn't been doing a whole lot with it. But it's and I actually haven't looked at it in a long time, but she does periodically update it and try to keep many of the protocols on there.
You just caught me because I guess I didn't do my homework good enough. I thought that was one of your sites.
Well, most people, she should just say, you know, Stephen Buhner isn't affiliated with this site, but, you know, she doesn't. So a lot of people think it's mine, but it's fine. Anyway.
So where would you like to go next? Would you like to go with one of your protocols and talk about them, or how would you like to go next? I mean, I have lots of questions, but I don't want to make it too technical. So
well,
tell me how
you know, most of the people that we've ended up having contact with over the last 10 years or so, most of them are suffering from, there is central nervous system difficulties of one sort or another. I mean, like, when you get into it, most of these disease organisms in this group, what they do is that they're parasites. They have to scavenge the nutrients they need from our bodies to survive, and it's wherever they're scavenging those nutrients, that's where you get disease symptoms. So a number of them, mycoplasma and Lyme, for instance, both of them, when they get into the brain, they begin to break down the myelin sheaths around the nerves, and that's the same thing that happens in multiple sclerosis. So, and because they're very good at sequestering themselves inside various cellular structures and that they're very hard to find and very hard to treat, that's why antibiotics aren't always effective. Though, just as an aside, probably the most generally effective antibiotic for the entire group is doxycycline. So that's probably the best way to start if somebody's going to use a pharmaceutical. But so what we look at doing is that rather than focusing on trying to kill the organism, what these organisms do when they get in the body is they, you know, they sequester themselves in hard to reach places so the immune system can't deal with them very easy. They tend to change their genomic structure and their outer protein coat rapidly so that the immune system can't really keep up with them. And what they do is they release a series of molecules called cytokines, and they begin to modulate the body's own production of those molecules to stimulate certain ones to be released and others to never be released. And what those do is they cause inflammation at local sites in the body, and the inflammation then breaks down cellular structures. And that then, once those cellular structures break down, the organisms can feed off of the nutrients that are released during the breakdown. But wherever they break down stuff is where they cause the symptoms that we begin to experience. So our approach to treating it has been for the last 10 years, and it's worked really, really well for many, many people, and that is to, you know, look at what the cytokine profile is, the cytokine cascade, and what kind of molecules are they releasing, and then begin to use herbs or supplements, if supplements will be effective, to stop that process, to basically counteract the inflammation that they're creating. So once you do that, then they aren't able to scavenge for nutrients, and they basically are sort of starved out of the body. And then at the same time, if you support whatever organ system is having trouble in the body, like Bartonella, as soon as it gets in the body, it tends to infect red blood cells, the liver, the spleen, and the bone marrow. And that's one of the reasons why bone pain is part of the symptom that Bartonella causes. So you'll get quite often, you'll get spleen and liver enlargement. And so for something like that, you know, to protect the liver, milk thistle seed is really good for that. To help the spleen, red root is really good for that. The herb are very sophisticated at being able to shut down the inflammation dynamics that the bacteria create and also at the same time to provide specific organ protection.
What happens, as you were talking about this, it made me think about one of my, a specific client that I have. They have sciatica, and they have random rage, and they always have sore throat. That sounds like Bartonella, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly, that's one of the ways.
They've done everything possible, and then they've had nutritional analysis done. They've done everything, but not this. And it just occurred to me when you said rage a minute ago.
And that's one of the major signs, and it's quite frightening for people's families and for the practitioners, because in our culture, people really aren't used to dealing with extreme episodes of rage. It terrifies almost everybody, and we don't really understand it as a symptom that needs to be engaged with and moderated. So the reason why that tends to happen in Bartonella is Bartonella tends to infect the amygdala in the brain, which is where a lot of the emotional a lot of the emotions are processed there, and it tends to stimulate that. So one of the things that we use to reduce the inflammation in the brain there, for instance, is cordyceps. It's a mushroom. We use a tincture of it, usually a quarter to a half a teaspoon, 3 to 6 times a day, depending upon what kind of the symptom picture is. Like for that extreme rage and stuff, vervain really tends to help that. It's a really good plant for that. So it can be turned around, and we find with Bartonella it is one of the more difficult ones, but it usually takes about a year in really serious instances to turn it around.
Wow. What makes it randomly come and go?
The episodes?
Yes.
Well, the Bartonella, they reproduce about a 24-hour schedule. And so what's really fascinating is that all of these co-infectious organisms, they sequester themselves in different parts of the body to better able to survive the immune response. And they create a lot of antigenic variants of themselves also to better avoid the immune response. But what's fascinating about Bartonella is where it sequesters itself. It gets into those four primary locations, but it also sequesters itself in endothelial cells. That's where it reproduces. And it causes a kind of endothelial hyperplasia. It stimulates the production of more endothelial cells, which is basically kind of like it's the lining of blood vessels. But what's fascinating is all of the groups in the body in the different locations synchronize their behavior, and every 5 days they release more organisms into the body. So you begin to see this kind of periodic resurgence of symptoms, you know, between 5 and 12 days, that it'll just resurge up and then it'll recede back. And it's,
you are absolutely right. I see that when I see this client. That's amazing.
It's very common. It's very common. And the book, The Healing Lyme Disease Co-Infections for Bartonella and Mycoplasma, that has a really extensive, real sophisticated protocol for Bartonella and talks a huge amount about all of these specific things that can occur.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go to the next one. Can you talk about metals, natokinase, and the arginine, nitric oxide issues?
Okay, well, like L-arginine is an incredibly important supplement to use in treating Bartonella, for instance, and it's also extremely helpful in Lyme disease, because Lyme spirochetes also like to infect the endothelial cells. And the thing about L-arginine is that it stabilizes endothelial structures. And with Bartonella, just simply, in some instances, just simply supplementing with 500 to 1,000 milligrams of L-arginine during the day can help. It can completely reverse Bartonella symptoms because it normalizes the endothelial structure and it stops them from being able to engage in that kind of hyperplasia. So there's probably each different co-infection has a whole, I look in detail at the parts of the body it affects and how it does that, and then come up with a protocol that can address those particular things. So, another thing that's really useful in Bartonella, because they infect red blood cells, is an herb called Theta acuta. It's a member of the fan petal family. It's invasive along the Gulf Coast of the United States. And it's a really interesting plant because it's a systemic antibacterial. It's extremely strong, and it's active against most of the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that people are dealing with these days. But the really unique thing about it is that it protects red blood cells, and it stimulates the production of more red blood cells. So during Bartonella infections or Mycoplasma or Babesia, anemia is a really common symptom. And so, but the interesting thing about CETA is that it stimulates the production of new red blood cells and protects the ones that are already in existence. And you'll get a turnaround from anemia from those causes really quickly. It's fairly astonishing.
So what about, got two questions here. What about the people that can't take arginine because of whatever viruses they might have? And how does that play into the B12 thing with for the anemia? So it's not really, maybe it might not really be B12, it might be this problem? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, there's so many different things that can go on. You have to realize these bacteria have been around for 3.5 billion years, and so they've gotten really adept at what they do. Our species has been around, if you really extend it really far, about 1 million years, in current form about 35,000 years. So we're basically, the young kids on the block. So, Mycoplasma, one of the things that Mycoplasma does, for instance, is that it can't make any of the nutrients it needs at all, period. So when it gets into the body, it scavenges everything. And one of the major things it scavenges is the entire B complex. So supplementation with B in Mycoplasma is really important. And, there's a lot of different causes of anemia. If the bone marrow is compromised and it's not making more the kind of stem cells that end up becoming red blood cells, which can happen with in Babesia, Ehrlichia, and Anaplasma infections, for instance, and to some extent in Bartonella, then you need to do things to protect and enhance bone marrow function. And, there's a number of herbs that are extremely good for that. So it's more trying to get a very sophisticated grouping of herbs based on what these things do and their symptoms so that, and more by explaining what they're doing in the body, it actually makes it, and I find in my own experience, a lot less frightening. You kind of have an idea, and it gives you a place to start, and then you can kind of begin tweaking the protocol to match your particular body type.
So how do you spell that herb? You said Theta acuta. How do you spell that?
It's S-S-I-D-A. That's the genus name.
Mm-hmm.
And the species is acuta, but many of the Thetas are used interchangeably. That's just
okay.
The one that seemed the strongest to me.
Okay. That's just so interesting. So what if, I was reading on this woman's website about people that have, what do they call it, shortness of breath or can't remember how she worded it, but people that can't get a good breath.
Yeah, they call that air something.
Yeah, I lost
the
word.
That kind of inability to really take in air, and that seems to be kind of a common problem with a lot of people. Increasing the numbers of red blood cells can really help that. And from what do they call that? That air hunger. That's the
yes,
term
air
for
hunger.
It. air hunger. And, you know, we found a number of good herbs for that, which would be...
I have that ailantus. Really bad.
Yeah, ailantus is a really good herb for that. And it's also called Tree of Heaven or Chinese sumac. It's an invasive botanical, and we've had some really good success with that in dealing with air hunger.
That's about the only thing, that and some mucus issues that I was telling this woman today, so I can't believe you actually know about that. I have this thing where I can't get a good breath, and it drives me crazy. Nobody knows what it is. They tried to tell me it was, you know, a heart attack or this or that. I just wanted to clap my hands when I saw that on that woman's site.
That's an interesting thing. You know, that I suppose probably 15% of the people that contact us have air hunger issues.
And so what dosage of that stuff would you take?
Well, ailantus is an interesting herb. It's, you know, we've had people that occasionally that couldn't swallow for some reason.
I get that sometimes, too. Not often, but sometimes.
And we've given them, like, just 1 to 3 drops of ailantus, and it'll turn it around right away. Other people will take up to, you know, a half a teaspoon 3 or 4 times a day. And that's one of the things, you know, a lot of people, I have suggested dosages in all of these books. But one of the things that's really fascinating is the dosage range and the co-infection amongst that group of microbes. It's really astonishing. We've seen like 260-pound, 6-foot-5-inch guys who can only take 1 to 3 drops of a tincture, 98-pound demure women, 5-foot-tall, that need to take a teaspoon at a time. So there's this massive range. So for most people, we just say this is a suggested dosage range, and you just start taking it, and then you know, just begin to get increasing the dose, and you'll find the range that works for you. So, you know, I tend to take larger doses myself because, well, I'm a guy, and guys take, you know, we can handle it.
Uh-huh.
So, but really, actually, sometimes 3 or 4 drops is enough for other people. They need more. So you just practice with it, really. There's very few of these herbs that can cause harm. So, you know, most of them are food-grade herbs, and you know, so you can just play around with the dosage range.
What about the arginine issue? You need that, but if you have, a, you know, herpes or cold sores or whatever,
right,
you can't take it. What do you do?
Right, if you've got an active outbreak of something like that, of the chickenpox virus group, then it can exacerbate it. If it's not an active outbreak, it generally will not cause an outbreak. But in that instance, the primary herb we suggest is Japanese knotweed root, because it normalizes endothelial function as well. And also it shuts down, it's almost the perfect herb for Lyme infections, in that it will shut down nearly the entire cytokine cascade. And for a lot of people, just simply using Japanese knotweed and then cat's claw for their immune function will just turn around Lyme disease entirely.
What about heavy metals? Do you know any herbal thing that, or does that even play a role in Lyme's or any of the co-infections?
Heavy metals. There's a lot of people that are really interested in detoxing from heavy metals. And, you know, there's a lot of back and forth in all of the Lyme support group websites about that. Some people insist it's absolutely essential. Other people said it doesn't really make any difference. You know, if people really feel that it's essential, then chlorella is an extremely good herb to use to help with that kind of detoxification.
Okay, we have 15 minutes, and I want to make sure that you get to talk about anything you want to talk about before I question your ear off here. Is there anything that you want to make sure you cover?
No, I'm kind of focusing on, you know, anytime I think of something, I just take your question and go where I want with it. I don't know if you've noticed that.
That works for me. The next thing I'd like to ask you about is hypercoagulability. I saw something about that, and I think that's an important thing.
That is a common problem with some of these co-infections, hypercoagulability. So, you know, I can't say that word, but I'm sure everybody listening knows exactly what I mean. You know, this time of night, my lips and my tongue don't work quite well. But that particular thing is a problem. And so that's one of the reasons with people, if they have, you know, intravascular coagulation problems, we don't usually suggest red root, which is really a good one for the spleen and helping spleen function. Rather than that, we go to an herb, and my brain just went completely... Salvia militarizer, red sage. It's called Dan Shen sometimes in Chinese practice. And it's really specific for helping the spleen and liver function, but it also is an anticoagulant, so it really helps that. And so some of the people with hypercoagulation problems, like aspirin is really good for that. The red sage is really good for that. N-acetylcysteine is really good. Natokinase is also good.
Okay. So if somebody takes that, do they have to be careful? And you may not know that, I don't know. If they take fish oils or vitamin K, do they have to be careful? Are there any contraindications of any of these things they have to be careful of?
Well, I usually put all the contraindications that I can find in the book. And sometimes, you know, there's always the potential for individual idiosyncratic responses to any of these things. But, you know, some of these are not good if you're pregnant or if you're trying to get pregnant or things like that. But, you know, normally I normally read anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 journal papers every time I'm working on these things. And I really search every source I can. And so every potential side effect or contraindication that is out there that I can find has been listed for each of these plants.
So how do these things affect cartilage and collagen?
Okay, well, Lyme disease, that's one of the things the Lyme spirochetes do. They love collagen. That's their primary thing that they like to break down and get food from. So and that's why you'll see wherever it breaks down, if they're breaking it down in the knee, you get arthritis. If they're breaking it down in the brain, you get, you know, symptoms like multiple sclerosis. So, you know, the approach that we go with is to stop the inflammation that they're causing, which in and of itself will slow that down, and then also use things that will help regenerate the collagen tissues in the body and help them be really strong. And so that really does turn around a lot of the symptoms from Lyme.
What do you remember, what you recommend for cartilage and collagen, or give people a kind of an idea of a thing or two?
Well, vitamin C is really good, and I'm particularly fond of glucosamine sulfate myself. And then there's gelatin that you can actually get, gelatin that you can use as a supplement, and that also seems to help quite a bit.
Okay. And what about inflammation and pain? How do they deal with that so they can...
Pain's an interesting thing. You just happen to get into an area that's really fascinating to me when you ask that question, because I was on an airplane with this guy who's a doctor, who's a pain doctor. We had
Hold on one second. Did you just shift in your chair because we got a buzzing? There it went away.
I did shift in my chair. I moved 3 inches. So, but anyway, he really stimulated some great thought for me. And there's a number of really unique pain dynamics that occur with some of these diseases that are similar. It's similar to diabetic neuropathy, this kind of weird pain that opiates can't even touch. But one of the major herbs that we found that's really, really useful for that is kudzu root, because there's these certain pain receptors in the brain that are activated by the bacterial infection. And once they're activated, you'll start getting this really strange pain in different parts of the body that pain relievers just can't touch, but kudzu can turn it around almost every time. It's really
now. I'm from the South. Are you? And I just want to make sure
yes,
I understand.
I am.
Are you talking about kudzu?
Yep, that's exactly what I'm talking
okay.
about.
Okay.
Kudzu versus kudzu.
I just wanted to make sure I understood.
I'm from Kentucky, and we know how to pronounce all words perfectly. So, no, but the root of that herb is really, really phenomenal for that kind of pain. And there's certain kind of receptors that they're known by. But and also another herb that's really good for that is motherwort. And motherwort does a really nice double duty, too, because it helps people relax. It lowers anxiety. It can help with sleep. It will help reduce pain because it affects some similar pain receptors. It works really well along with kudzu. And the other thing is that it's really neat for it's a mitochondrial protector. And a number of these diseases will affect the mitochondria, which is part of where the severe fatigue comes from. So motherwort actually protects the mitochondria and stimulates their regeneration and keeps them healthy. So using it for a while, for a month or so, you can really see some great effects from that herb.
What about, and we don't have long now, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes, what about free radical scavengers or something to address free radicals? Oh, one other question. I'll let you think about both of these. Do you know if ozone is beneficial to treat any of these things? I have this ozone machine that a friend made. It doesn't have an oxygen tank. It takes it directly from the air, so that it's not that concentrated, but it is medicinal grade. So I wonder.
Well, that's one of the things. You know, a lot of people are looking for one-picture answers to these diseases. And the things we say, you know, that I constantly, you know, emphasize is that this just, you know, the protocols we talk about, it just gives people a place to start. You know, add anything that you think will work, get rid of anything that doesn't work. Because when you get into the Lyme world and the co-infection world, these are some of the most activist, you know, intelligent, deep-thinking people since the AIDS crisis, when people had to find solutions outside of the medical world because the medical world doesn't work well for them. And so there's so many different things that people have found that help. Now, some people have said ozone really works for them. Other people think, you know, regular sweat baths work for them. And there's just a wide, wide range. And, you know, pretty much there's somebody that's been helped by just about everything that's out there. So, but ozone is not a thing that we've used a whole lot. I've just seen that it's helped some people.
You know, I did this really interesting, I hate to take up the last minute, but I did this really interesting interview with this guy a few months back named Gerald Pollack. And he had been doing research with water. And he had been using infrared light. And he said when he used infrared light on the body, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it caused certain pathways to open up, and funguses, you could see them under the microscope flow out of where they were, funguses, viruses, and bacteria, flow out of the body and go back in when you took the light away. So that's why people always say, you know, do infrared saunas. But really all you got to do is get in infrared light. You don't have to do all the sweating. Just have that light on you, according to that man's research. It was very interesting.
It is. I mean, and that's one of the neat things about this second generation of pathogens that are coming out. They're stimulating so much tremendous innovation in people to find solutions. And I think it's opening up the medical world in a way that it really needed to be opened up, because they've tended to be so insular and unaware of the real nature of a lot of these diseases. And that's one of the great teachings of Lyme and the co-infections. They're forcing a kind of awareness on the American population that we've desperately needed for a long time.
You're absolutely right. And I'd like for you to take a minute, because we're about to wind down, but your other book, antibiotic resistant. Remember that one that you did?
Oh, sure.
That
herbal
big
antibiotic
one?
For resistant bacteria. Yeah.
I'd just like for you to tell people about some of your other books so that they know they exist.
Well, that one I've written 20. So, Authorial Bloat's my middle name. I can't stop. It's a habit. But
thank God
that particular book, I've been really concerned about resistant bacteria for over 20 years now, and it turns out that plants are extremely effective for treating them, and we've had a lot of success helping people that have resistant staph infections, and you know that's sort of where it really started. And this new one looks at, oh, I forget how many of them, and I think there's 17 majorly resistant organisms now that are real problematic in hospitals and in the general community, and so that looks at all of those. And then there's a companion book on emerging viruses as well that goes with that one.
So in 3 minutes, if you had to basically stock your medicine cabinet with some important things, is there a bullet list of a few that you would absolutely have?
Oh, sure. Cryptolepis is an herb that I really like. It's a systemic antibacterial. It's a broad spectrum. It's against both gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria. It's really quite marvelous.
Can
no
you spell
side
that?
Effects that we, yeah, CryptoLepis. It's a marvelous herb. Houtainia is really good. It's quite effective. Against mycoplasma, for instance, it's a marvelous herb. It has some effects in treating Bartonella. Japanese knotweed, which is also an invasive plant, it's quite
now you have
wonderful.
To spell that Houtainia because we're not you.
Houtainia.
Yeah.
Houtainia. H O U T T U Y N I A.
Because people will be emailing me, and I won't have a clue what to tell them. Okay.
And Isatis is another one. It's an invasive herb that's it's effective against mycoplasma, too, and it is also a very broad-spectrum antiviral herb. It's like Houtainia is also a broad-spectrum antiviral herb, so they're both really good for, you know, viruses of various sorts. And Echinacea angustifolia, I never use purpurea. I don't think it's a very good herb, but Echinacea angustifolia is incredibly effective for a huge number of things, strep throat, for instance. And so those are in some of the ones that I use frequently.
That's most excellent. You want to give Julie's website again?
Yeah, you can find out more about us or contact us through GaianStudies.org, GAIANStudies.org.
You're the best, Stephen. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule
to
be on my show.
Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Honored. Thank you. Good night.
Bye. Bye-bye.